Okay, for the first time, it seems that we have capability of making actual lecture videos instead of those truly horrible screencasts that I've been recording for you. The ball was somewhere. Anyone watched those screencasts? I know that I sound pretty much like the Gollum from The Lord of the Rings trying to explain functional programming, but that is useful. Have you checked them out? These, no. Has anyone watched any of these? Yeah, so few people. Do you have any strong opinions? No, the quality is absolutely horrible, but I'm not a voice actor, I guess. Well, no opinions, so we have ordinary lecture videos if I can manage to make this. Socrative, I think we all got that. So team up and go to that address. And the agenda for this lecture. Like previously, we go over some old stuff. We go over some exercises. Then we are going to talk about types some more. In my experience, types are probably the most difficult part in the course. They are not actually difficult. They are just something that people usually don't have any prior experience with. So it's usually the part where people drop out from my course. So I spent more time talking about types, which is probably going to lead to more people dropping out from the course, but it might have the opposite effect also. So I'm going to talk about how Haskell actually decides what the type for your expression is. And then I'm going to show you how to write programs based solely on the type information inside the programs. Basically, there's one exercise in the course that I gave to students of the last year's course instance. It took them something like, on average, 4 or 5 days to complete. And it was funny since the exercise is clearly of the type that if you know what you are doing, it takes, honestly, less than 60 seconds to complete. So I'll show you how to do that, and then we measure if my efforts were at all useful. If it only takes you 1 day, then they were. If I manage to put you in the order of minutes to complete that exercise, that'd be excellent, but probably not going to happen. So something about exercises. Exercises for this time, you are probably, completed or almost completed all these type exercises. You have met my pretty vague exercises about ice cream and ice cream salesmen. These have been, somewhat causing difficulties, mostly because they are not well-specified exercises. There's not a single answer, and, there's this problem that they probably assume a bit too much. If you don't have a long programming experience, you probably don't know how to model programs, or you don't have an intuitive idea of, I have to make these types that the computer is going to process, and it's going to process them somehow, and so on. And the program is basically composed of different types and transitions between them. So if I haven't taught you about that and then asked you to make types for ice cream salesmen, it's probably not going to, really work. And one technical thing in this is that there's two kinds of types in Haskell. There's some types and there are product types. And this difference is probably, most crystallized in this counting types exercise. Since there's this idea that almost all languages have product types. Product types means that you have two types and you somehow join them together. For example, if you are C-sharp programmers, you have a class, and you have class members. So you have a class that contains two other classes and an int. So that is a product type. And in Haskell, we have product types. We have pairs, we have lists, we have all kinds of stuff that allows us to pair multiple types into one big ball of types. The ball can then represent a person or salesman or ice cream booth, whatever have you. But the difficulty is that in Haskell, we also have these sum types, which are not agglomeration of types. They are things that can contain either this type or this other type. So they basically work in the exact opposite way of ordinary composing types into bigger structures. And I read through the answers, and I think most of you, based on the answers I read, got this question wrong. So in order to squash this bug about different kinds of types in Haskell, I'm going to make a small test. Yeah, okay, some questions there. So So let's make a quick check. Everyone has done this exercise that asks you to count how many different ways there are to make an iter bool pool type. And most of you have gotten a reply from a TA that states that you are correct or not so much correct or something in between. So now we are going to make a small test. We are going to do this peer instruction thing where you first go and vote on the Socrative system. Figure out the answer for this question. Then, when you have done so, pick your three friends, have a short discussion, convince your friends that your answer is correct. And then we discuss shortly about this. Mainly this is done because it's a very early exercise. We shouldn't be talking about it anymore. But this has gone wrong so many times that I have to make sure that everyone got this eventually. So let's do this. First vote, then discuss with your mates. No. I'm expecting some kind of a movement to appear in that side of the glass. Does it work? Okei, kääntykää ympäri, sinun on kaveri, jolla on ilmeisen toimivan läppäri. Okay, you're all getting silent. Have you? Well, let me check. So 22 out of 20 answered, which is, and here's the result. So 70% or 71% now, four, obviously. Why obviously? You have the poll. What is? Did your group end up with this? So this is a funny exercise in two ways, because it's so very easy to try. You know, you type info either and it tells you either can be either can be left A or it can be right B. You type info bool and it says that bool can be true or false. And then write through, yeah, that's something. Yeah, that's either A or bool. Could be right type. To make this absolutely certain, we could write like this. And since the compiler accepts it, yeah, then it's going to be of that type. Right false, that's two. Left false, that's also true. And right false, that's also true. So it's four different possibilities. So what is either actually. It's a tagged union. So it tells me both what the value was, if the value was a true or false, or it was another true or false. It also tells me which one of these it was. So it's usable in cases where you have this, say, possibility for an error. Your function might return the correct result, or it might return some message why the result couldn't be computed. Your ice cream booth, it's either an open ice cream booth, and then it contains ice cream and the seller, or it's a closed ice cream booth, and then it also only has an address. So you can make things that are either of these two things. It's either of left side something or right side something. It's completely opposite of what usually happens. Now, since in lectures I've been told that I have to, you know, go deeper than in the lecture material, I'm unfortunately have to admit that answer D is not actually correct. It is correct in the sense what I meant in the example. But what I did here is I tested with this interpreter and tried to figure out how many different values I can have or different ways of constructing values here. So I can actually do this without using either of the left or right constructors. I can do something like this. Yeah, that's going to hold. Of course, it's infinite recursion. But if I ask the type of it, the type will be either bool bool. Actually, if I make an infinite recursion or program that never finishes computation, it's going to be whatever type I like. It's never going to return anything, so I can use it anywhere in my program. And just like that, the program will compile, but it will never do anything. Also, I have these programmer-specific things like, you know, exceptions. So in some cases, I might actually want a runtime error in my program. All my assumptions have gone south. The program has no idea what it's going to ever do again. So I can say error and some message. And I get an exception that terminates the entire program. In shell, it's going to just terminate the computation for this specific calculation. And also, error. Yeah, I can have errors of any type, which means that I can write error in any place of any expression I want. So it has type A, it's of any possible type. Types like these are called, or values like these are called bottoms. It's a bottom value. It has no sensible interpretation. It doesn't compute into anything. And this is something that is unique to, you know, us computer scientists. We need to make programs that compute whatever. So we can't preclude the possibility of making a program that actually never terminates. In practice, this is a, you know, not so big problem. But with this exercise, if we want to be really theoretical, it means that there's at least 5 different ways of making this type. Okay. Does anyone see the 6th way of making this type? I can write a bottom in place of right or left or this whole expression. That's, you know, I can write bottom there. It's right true, right false, left true, or bottom. Any other values for this? That are distinctly different from either right or left and a Boolean and distinctly different from a bottom. This is also a trick question. It's not an easy question. Any thoughts? No? Deep silence, concerned faces. So, yeah, let's try with a ball. Pick someone who looks like he has guts to answer. Yeah, there's people going, no, not me. Okay, three throws with the ball, and then I tell you answer if you don't know. No idea. Lost the ball. No idea. One more. Just throw. Okay, find the ball, and I'll tell you the answer meanwhile. So, basically, I have multiple ways of making different bottoms. I have this bottom that never terminates, this another bottom that throws an exception, but they are all practically same. The program never completes with a result. So bottoms are indistinguishable. I can't know what caused the program to fail. I can't, you know, tell about the exception and infinite recursion or something like that. So those we agree are just one value. But I can also do this. I can nest the bottom value inside the either type. So this is of the correct type. I can have the value stored there. But the value is not actually bottom. I can calculate with that value. Since Haskell is a lazy language, I don't have to evaluate what's inside of the right constructor. And I can do something like I'm very careful not to touch the, you know, value that's going to blow in my face, and so return something. Yeah, I can use the value x. And it's not a right false, or it's not the right true, but still a different value. So I can have, you know, four, you know, these ordinary nice values. Then I have one value that is bottom in its entirety. Then I have one value that is left and a bottom, and then there's one value that's the right and a bottom. So that's the whole story. And the answer is actually F. If you calculate all these, we get seven values. So I guess this was somewhat a trivia discussion, but it's actually useful to know. Because in Haskell, we mix these types that are infinite and finite. So we might have things like you know, this is the, what? Yeah, thanks. This is an old hat, you know, something that everyone demonstrates to Haskell beginners, but no one actually uses for anything. So I have an infinite list of natural numbers. So I can take 50 natural numbers from that list. Now, it's easy to see if I work with values that are infinite, that I'm very prone to get a bottom value out of this. Consider, I have the function to get the last character, and you know, guess what this is? You know, I take infinite list and then try to pick the last element of it. Never gonna work. However, I'm now into this gray area. I have this nice value y. I can take something out of it, but some functions are going to fail totally. So the business why I'm talking about this idea of having errors here is basically this. I can have something that is not an error, but it contains something that never finishes computing if I leave it running. So this allows us to play more tricks. We have value like either. There's something inside of it. It can be something that we never finish calculating it. But if we are very careful, like we have been here, that we don't touch the stuff inside unless we are really sure that we need it, it's going to be completely okay in our programs. Allows us a bit more modularity and a bit more flexibility. So, yeah, that's the question about this. Any questions or comments about this particular beast? No. None. Okay, continue. So, why was this exercise difficult? I mean, this is, I'm actually asking you why this was difficult. Since when you submitted the exercise, almost 75% of you said, yeah, there's two different values. And, you know, any guesses why it was so difficult? You know, this is not really part of this course. I'm just in general interested why everyone said two to this question. So both, give me a hint if you have any. Because I would have guessed that people say, you know, four for wrong reason, or don't say anything, or say one. But why specifically two? Why was, you know, the answer B so attractive? Any ideas? Yes. Yes, please. So you were thinking about unions, you know, it's a, you know, you get a boolean, it's either of these booleans, but you don't actually know which one it is. Yeah. Then you get two answers, yes. Yeah, and this is a funny concept to me, since of course it's natural to think like this, but I know only of, you know, one language that you can actually do this, and it's something so old that you probably haven't, you know, at least studied it officially. It's C. C has unions that work like this. It wasn't intuitively sure that either itself is a type. Ah, yes, great, great point. So even in this slide we have many different things. So bools are types. Either bool is a type. It's a, you know, type composed of some other things. Another question. Anyone have idea if either without the parameters, is that a type? If I write just either, is it a type? Can I say, this? I make a statement like this. No. You probably already have tried. Why can't I make? Is the ball found? Yeah, I pick someone who. Okay, we should have some sports pupils here, so ball gets caught more often. So, do you have an explanation why why this is not a type? Yeah, exactly. So it's not a type; it's a thing that makes types. So if I say this, it's going to be it's going to say that, yeah, it's not a valid type. You need to give two more arguments to it. And so if I give it one argument, it still says, yeah, one more is needed. And now it's a type. This is a type constructor. It works just like functions, but it operates on level of types. So the same intuitions apply. For example, I can put parentheses here like this and so on. Also, if you are interested in things like this, there's this kind command, which tells you the same thing as, yeah, let's contrast. Type tells you a type of a function or a value. Kind tells you how you use your types. So kind of either is star, arrow, star, arrow, star. It's a kind of a type level function. It takes two types. Star means an ordinary type. It takes two of them and returns you an ordinary type. But we don't have to worry about kinds in, you know, for weeks. They are not that essential right now. Yeah, and I guess the whole idea is that, you know, I was just not clear on my material. But your explanation, I think, is close to home for most people. So, then the question, why did I ask you this in the first place? Well, obviously, the majority of your answers were wrong. I kind of expected them to be wrong, not so many, but quite many, because this exercise is a you know, it's a principal kind of these gate exercises. When you know how it works, it's very fast to do. You say four and done. But if you don't know how to do it, then this is going to, you know, flag you as a person who didn't get the exercise, and a TA will come and explain it to you through the web system. So majority of the answers were wrong. Perhaps you learned something since the TAs had to correct you. And I learned something. I explained the ITER very badly. So I have to rewrite the material. So that is why the exercise was in place. I fully admit that making an exercise where you have to program something fun would have been, you know, nicer, but this was probably more effective in this particular case. So back to this idea. ITER is a sum type, and it's a dual to product types. So all languages have a product type. You know, structs, classes, tuples, objects, arrays, lists. All of these things are something that you can pack multiple other types inside. In some languages, you of course can't put multiple different types in a list or array. But in objects, you can collect types of all kinds, make these agglomerate types. So this is common idea. Everyone who has learned programming knows how these work. In Haskell, you make pairs, triples, tuples. In Python, you make classes. In JavaScript, you make objects. So, some types. Types like ITER. These are rare. Hardly any language allows you to make new sum types. You know, it's becoming more popular, but you know, Java? No. C sharp? Not really. You have to make this huge trick with classes, and it's not very nice. JavaScript? Definitely no. So, there are also this idea that, you know, sum types themselves, they are common, but you can't define your own. Almost all languages have built-in sum types. You know, Boolean, it's a sum type. It's either true or false. Int, that is a sum type. It's either 1, or it's a 2, or it's a 3, or it's a 4, and so on to the infinity. Characters are sum types. It's either A, or B, or it's C, and so on. And these are actually, in my mind, essential. Because, for example, one big problem that we get when we don't have this idea of sum types in our language is we get this null pointer or null reference fallacy. It says basically that if you have a pointer or reference to some object in most, you know, your common languages, it might not have the object inside. It's kind of a, you know, this maybe-like thing. It's either it's a null reference or it's an actual reference for the object. And this is something that you always have to check. When you write a Java function, you always have to include some kind of a check or assertion that you are actually getting an object as argument and not a null. And that's really annoying, and there are many, you know, tricky ways of making that easy to write. But the whole point is that this whole null business is not necessary if you have some types. Because then you can track inside your types if your value can be null or it cannot be null. So in Haskell, you can actually have values, you know, which are not null values. If it says you have an int, you will always have a computation that will produce an int. Or it will, you know, go to an infinite loop or something, but that we cannot fix. So our program has a reference to something. We forget one, is it null, test, and then everything blows up in our faces. And the problem is that we are so used to this. This is, you know, the third thing we learn in programming one. You have to check if it's a null. So we don't care about that anymore. But, you know, we should listen to this smart guy. Anyone know who this dude is? This guy is Tony Hoare. He is a brilliant computer scientist, one of the, I guess, founding fathers even of the field. He's actually so brilliant that he got this knighthood from, you know, Queen of England, so he's a really smart man. And he's actually stating that null reference is his very own billion-dollar mistake. He actually invented null reference. There's a, you know, the guy who is responsible for them all. And here's the gold. So basically he was designing a language, you know, very early. It was one of the first object-oriented programming languages. And it just happened that, you know, allowing a reference to be null was very easy. So it didn't change the specification of the language too much, and since, you know, he decided, let's have one extra feature in the language. And then, you know, 40 years afterwards, this has cost, you know, honestly, billions of dollars of missed NALA reference checks. You know, I guess there's some people who have, you know, terminated the entire programming careers because they can't find the bloody NALA reference bug in their code. So this has actually cost money and time and human suffering. So, few examples in Haskell where we have these some types. Here are this thing that, you know, the top, we have these exercises that already did. There were fine examples on some types, so I reused them. So, for example, this is a kind of a, you know, how would I say, NALA reference error, kind of a thing like that. You are calculating how many months does it take you to save something. And obviously, if this function returns you a negative value, it's going to mean that you are never going to get that much money ever, which is not so nice. But if you further chain this computation, take the result, feed it into some other computation, then you get a number as a result. And if there's enough operations in the chain before the number is printed for the user, the minus sign might, you know, disappear. There might be an absolute value somewhere or something like this. So your code will silently give wrong results without any possibility of you detecting them. Same with this get domain. I stole this from someone, I don't remember who. And also, string goes in, string comes out. We have no way of knowing without reading through the whole function if the string actually represents the domain of the URL or not. So, again, this string might start traveling in our program, enter some critical function somewhere, and then blow up everything. The idea with some types is that we can encode this assumption that our values are not always there in the type declaration. So adding even the simplest some type like the maybe, which can be nothing or just something, we allow ourselves to be explicit. In the first case, months to earn. We notice that this is a partial function. It might not always work. In some cases, we are unable to save a penny ever. So we make this explicit. We do not return a double. We return a maybe double. When the user of this function gets the maybe double, he can't pass it onwards as a double. He has to make a case statement. He has to make a branch that checks if it was a nothing or if it was actual sum. So the user of this function is less likely to screw up. He's not going to, you know, leave the check out because the types force him to have it there. Similarly to this get domain. So we can use an either type that, you know, returns right values only if it's somewhat certain. Yes, please. It's a constructor that doesn't contain anything. And if you would have just and nothing, you would have the same kind of NALA reference issue. But the point is that you have this type here. It's of different type from double. So if your function expects a double, you can't take a maybe double and cram it in the function. It's not going to compile. So this forces you to have the check. Of course, you can do something silly and say, make a case statement that unpacks this maybe type and, you know, raises a runtime error when it finds that it's nothing. That's easy to do and it's still wrong. But it's a conscious decision that you have to make. You have to decide that I will crash my program here. You know, surprisingly many people start doing this after, you know, a few months of programming in a hasty project. So here's an either. It's either a message that tells you why the thing couldn't be computed or gives the result if it's sure enough it could compute it. So either is used usually as a return value of a function, but it has many other uses. Anything to comment further on this? So I guess you are convinced that some types are great. And short hypothesis why we have NALA reference instead of some types. Because some types, we don't have to take all the Haskell to get some types. We could make a very small addition to all languages and replace NALA references with sums. But at the time, you know, when ALGOW was invented, it, this was a concept that not many people knew. Earliest reference was actually the programming language also designed by Tony Hoare, or partly designed by Tony Hoare, which actually had the sum types. So he actually took a step backwards when he added the null reference. And then there is this issue. If you take Java, for example, Java is slowly adopting these functional programming features. You have lambdas in Java 8 and so on. However, in Java, you will always have this null reference issue. Because if you add sum types to Java, if you add this nice maybe thing inside Java, it doesn't save you from the null problem, because the maybe something could also be null. So you can't fix this by adding additional parts once you have a null in your programming language. So some theory quickly. Let's actually skip the theory. More uses for sum types. I can talk about the theory in some screencasts that no one actually listens about them. This also saves a lot of human suffering. So this is also one of these traditional examples. If you go to course about object-oriented programming, someone is going to write something like this in the program to demonstrate to you how inheritance works and how polymorphism works. And if they make a real program, they never write something like this. But the idea is that this is how people try to sell object-oriented programming and polymorphism through inheritance. They make a class animal. If this is actually not C-sharp, then it's my fault. I can only write C-sharpish things, not actual C-sharp. We make a base class animal and then derive, I'm missing this, inherit from statement. Inherit the dog from the animal, inherit the cat from the animal. Each of them have some method that does different things. Then I can put them all in the same list, go over the same list, and make all animals make some kind of sounds. So the idea is that I can make heterogeneous collections. And you can correct my C-sharp code later. I can't write C-sharp, actually. But you get the idea. So the same in Haskell. This is a problem if I want all different kinds of animals in the same list, so I can uniformly process them. I can make this inheritance thing. Or I can use a sum type. I have no idea if these models are real-life animals either, but the idea is that I can make a type that is either a cat or a dog, reflecting this type hierarchy. Animal is either a cat or a dog. It can't be just animal because that was an abstract class and so on. And then since cat and a dog, they are values, and they both have type animal, I can put them into the same list. So if you run into this problem when modeling Haskell programs that I would need different kinds of values in the same collection, I need something like cats and dogs which behave differently in my game, I need to put them in the same list. Just make a sum type that has constructors for each possibility. So you don't need subtyping for that. And all in all, sum versus product types. I've talked way too long about this. Any questions, any comments? This is a fun topic. Sum types are probably very unfamiliar to you, but take a deep look. They're very useful. Eyes are starting to glaze over, so I'll probably go onwards. Then, back to this idea that we go through a few exercises in each lecture, just to see what the others have written. Today we have only few exercises because at this point of the course, most exercises were either rather bad or not done yet. So we have a few ones. And again, we do this by this vote fun thing. So the procedure, make a team. Here's three possible answers of how to actually evaluate a strange function like this. So to get you in the mood of how the TAs are actually going to think when reading through your answers, do this thing. First vote, which of these derivations would pass? Which of these are acceptable? Which of these explain how the function works? And then, you know, when you have made your choice, discuss with your friends if your choices are correct, why they are correct, why the ones that are not good derivations are not correct. And after this discussion, we will have a, you know, shared discussion about this topic. And I will also try to explain you why you had to do something boring as this. But please vote and discuss.
Varmaan helpompi siinä vaiheessa. Niin. Ja jos se tehtävä, mikä siellä on, on tylsä, niin sä saat tehdä jotain muuta, missä tulee ne samat asiat. Se ei pakko olla nimenomaan se.
Joo.
Et kunhan vaan kun näkyy, että oot hokannut ne asiat, mitä siellä yrität.
Se on. Joo, tehdään.
No, passari.
Okay, again, the point where everyone falls silent. Are you done? Is your discussion finished? Yeah, it seems to be finished since no one is saying anymore. You can actually, you know, argue more violently. You can, you know, shout and, you know, jump up or whatever. It's, you know, you're too, you know, cool back there. You know, hit the table and you're not right, I'm right. It makes this much more fun. You know, you can make this game where you pretend to be, you know, some dictator from early history and no, my way is correct. It's not so serious business. But anyway, you made the vote. I hope this works. And almost everyone says B is correct, C might be correct, D might be correct, and E might be correct. And A is what? C. Someone failed that, actually, at this point. So, A, B, and C. It might be C with, you know, high, small probability, but most people think it's B. Then you have discussed in groups, so everyone knows why. There's a ball somewhere in the class. Yeah, pick a group. And first group, your task, tell me why A is, you know, not correct at all. No idea. Okay, good. Two no ideas, then third somewhere. So this is an argument for this, and it's, you should probably, you know, use this somehow, because here it just, you know, disappears, right? Okay, anything else that is going to flag your, if you're trying to be a teaching assistant for this course, what else would you complain about? Throw the ball onwards. Because I think it might be that the guy here is somehow applying this function inside here and getting this 4 plus 4, but I don't know. Anything more? But hey, just throw the ball again. Yeah, any comments? Yeah, so one difficulty in here is that this part is interpreted wrong. Because what this actually reads, this first part, it's a function that takes an argument, which we call x. And then what we do with the x is we give the x an argument tyl. So the x passed in as a parameter is a function. We apply x with the value of tyl. Then we multiply by tyl. So the idea is that if we look only at this first part, assume that, you know, make a good-hearted assumption that this first part is correct. Then the problem is this. Function application is always of higher precedence than any operator, which means that if I have function, arguments, and then an operator, it means that this is the principal operator of this expression, means that it's the multiplication sign that takes as an argument x, 2, and the other 2. So this is how we split this expression apart. This is something I discussed in lecture 1 and lecture 2 also. So the order of things is wrong. X is not given as an argument, this 2 times 2. It's given only 2. And, you know, even if it was given this 2 times 2, which results in 4, there's still one extra multiplication sign, it's not going to be correct. C. I think we were somewhat convinced that it's probably not going to be C. So what's wrong here? Yes? Yeah, the problem is here. I can't split the expression apart, no, here. It changes the meaning. If I want to put parentheses around this expression, I parenthesize this part. This is function application, then the argument, then some operator, and so on. So the multiplication operator has this as the first parameter, or first argument. So the order of computation is wrong. I think we all understood this. At least based on the Socrative result, we are, you know, pretty clear on how this works. Any comments further, any questions about this? This should be clear at this point. If it's not clear, you know, pick one of my TAs and, you know, press him until it's clear for you. No comments? Then onwards to the course, to the section about types. That is going to be the hardest section during the course. If you pass that, then you pass the course. So there's an exercise. Choose a proper type for a function that applies some operation to every word in a string. Again, this is probably somewhat vague. This textual format is not conveying all the information you need to make this decision of what is the exact type. But which of these types are actually passable types? So if I was a nice TA, then which of these would I pass? Which of these types could I pass if I, you know, read the question in a very nice way? Which are passable and which are not? Why they are passable and why they are not? And the same thing. First, make a vote. Which is the things that you would consider if you got this kind of a Haskell value with this type? Would you consider that it could do an operation like this? And, you know, vote on those. You can vote on multiple things. After you've done the voting, then discuss with your friends, see if you can get a consensus idea of why this works. And also, if you have submitted an answer, and some of these are your answers, and the TA said it was wrong, don't listen to him. Make your own mind up about this. Come on, pretend to be politicians and make more sound. So I think I got how this works. It is not actually that you automatically fall silent at some point all at the same time. It's because I walk towards the computer and you fall silent at that point. I thought this was a mystic psionic phenomenon or something. Okay, are you done? No one is complaining, so let's see. So can I put this side by side? Cool, thanks. Someone who actually knows how to use Windows. Great. Aha, yeah. Right, okay. Excellent, I learned something new today. So we get this kind of a, you know, a result. There's only something that, you know, pretty much all of us are sure that E is not really a good answer. Ideas why? You have the ball, you get the pig who's going to be grilled with this question. Smack. No idea. Yep. Consider, if you have to implement a function, it takes two arguments. It takes this function that turns strings into A. You don't know what the A will be. Someone is going to call your function and he will decide that this A is an int or an animal or whatever. And then you have to implement a function that returns a string. It's given this kind of a, given this transformation that takes a string and turns it into something. You don't know what it is, but it's going to be something. And it takes another string. So question is, if I'm given a string, I have to return a string. And I have this kind of a transformations, or this kind of a transformation available to me. Can I use this function in the implementation of function E? Can I call this function? If I'm implementing E as a Haskell type, can I call it? So if I make let's return an identity function to check if I got. This is one way how you could implement the function. So the point is, can I use this parameter op, which has type string to A, in the definition of answer here? Is it possible to use? I mean, if I say op s, this gives me an, what is the type of op s?
A.
A, great. It's of type A. As an implementer of this function, I have no idea what A is. And now I'm supposed to, you know, return a string here. So what can I do with the A? How can I turn A into a string? I don't know anything about A. So, slight problem. Show works only on a restricted sets of types that have this constraint show in them. So if I don't have any restrictions on this, well, I can ask the compiler. If I use a modern GHC, version 7.8 at least, I can write underscores in my code. And underscore means that there's a place that I need to write something, I don't know what to write. And then the compiler will tell me, you have to write a function from A to string. Can't write a function from A to string, or can I? Yeah, it takes an A. Let's say V A value of A, and yeah, I can write this. This is a function from A to string. But what it actually does, it's going to just throw away the result of the previous function. So there's no way whatsoever that I can actually use E or make E do anything sensible. It can't use this first argument for any purpose. If it's the first argument is used to throw an exception, perhaps, but yeah, you were.
If you like, if that was calculating the length of the string, and inside the function you use that length result in an if statement or a var, and depending on the value of that, you have different kind of strings, then it would be.
Yeah, so if I suppose that the operation or op is length, then I can do this. But then the user of my function might actually call this with, you know, he's probably nasty. So s is a string and he's going to return, you know, true. That is a function of type string to A. So since we don't know how this is going to be used, we can't really can't do anything with it. And this is might seem like a bit of an academic question, you know. We are, you know, picking up some very tiny part of Haskell and making this huge fuss about it. But this is actually a very common problem. When you're starting out with Haskell, this is not the easy part. Okay, more. Then D and A are very nice. Does someone have the ball? What did you vote? Did you vote
A and B?
A and B. Why A? What is the thinking? Yeah. So, and this is the thing that if you wrote this as the answer of my exercise, at least one of my TAs said wrong, because he interpreted the exercise in a different way. So in this case, you interpret this that applies some operation, meaning that the operation is hard-coded inside the function. So the function turns all letters into uppercase. And the TA thought that applies some operation that the user supplies and applies that to all words in a string. So if you got a fail out of that, then you can argue with the TA and say, no, it's correct. Then B. B is not popular, but you all also had it. So any thinking behind that? intuitive answer, very good. Any contrary opinions? Who didn't vote for B? Find a person with a hand up and throw ball at the hand. You know, put the hand up and put, okay, here's a, one day we are going to get that correctly. So, B, why not B? Yeah, so if I'm going to implement this, let's make it, a thing of this type. And the first question is that how many parameters does this have? Only one. So I have a value like this. Well, this was B, I guess. And now question is, what can I write here? I need to return a string. I can, of course, return a constant string. This would be fine. But then, you know, if I want to use the parameter op, only thing I can do with that is actually I give it some constant string. So what did I just do? Sorry. No, I get confused also at times. So it can operate only on, you know, some hard-coded strings, some strings that the function already knows. A function that applies some operation to every word in a string. Well, again, this is a passable answer since it nowhere does it say that the string must be given by the actual user of this function. So yeah, I could pass that as an exercise. The part about which answer is correct is not so important. It's the reasoning behind why it's correct. Then C. Do you want to comment or throw the ball?
Well, C has the operation and another function which it passes with the input string.
Yeah. So the whole point.
No, sorry. I was talking about D. Yeah. No, I didn't want to see.
Yep, that. Yeah, it's going to happen sometime. Yeah, definitely correct. So also my skill at writing exercises, this is also a passable answer. Nowhere does it say that the result of this operation must be a string. You know, it certainly can apply, for example, length in every word of the string and return a list of integers. Brilliant, yeah, completely correct. And then you explained D also. D is probably what I had in mind when writing the exercise. I mean, it's a nice thing that takes a function from strings to strings, applies this to every word in a string, and then puts the words back together. And, you know, that's obvious after all these others. But, you know, take this as a hint how I write exercises. The exercises themselves neither make any sense nor have the right answer. They are only there to, you know, make you think for a while. And if you get this feeling that this bloody thing doesn't make any sense, then I've probably achieved my goal. You are thinking about something. So don't get frustrated if the exercise doesn't make any sense. You can also complain and I'll try to make it less vague, but it's not a point to stress over about. Yeah, so I guess we are done with this. We are almost done with the lecture, but continue. Do you want to do one more of these? Was it useful? Do you want to do one more?
Why not?
Yeah. The one person who is brave enough to talk to the class is now the class dictator. I like this, yes. So, choose prototypes for, and I'm going to hide for a while this answer. So, a function that sorts a list using user-specified sorting order. Very useful function. You are going to need this when you are going when you are programming. Which of these are, you know, sensible? Both, discuss, and then when you are done, you know, be silent for a while and I'll go back to the front of the computer. You know, the idea is vote first before discussion, because this actually allows you to make a, you know, better statement when you are talking to your friends. Okay. Cool. Are we approximately done? We have a conflict and approximately done everywhere else. So, let's see. Wait. I have to do it multiple times. So, and everyone's certain it's not E because there's no E. That's good. So it's pretty even. So I think I'll start with the, since you had an argument, get to share us the argument that you had.
Okay, so the argument is about option C, whether it works or not. I would like to claim it works because another thing, and it's not really your concern how you are going to get the first parameter. It, someone provides it to you, so you can certainly write this function. Whether you can write the function that satisfies that could be passed as a parameter is another
thing. Okay, I also want to hear the other side of the argument. Actually, this is, do other members of the class want to comment on? Yes, please. So basically, you agree with row number two. Any other comments on this? This is actually turning out to be interesting exercise. Any? So, do you want to hear my opinion about this? It's not perhaps the best, but yeah, whether C can work or not. You are both wrong and right at the same time. C can work. The whole point is that you claimed that if I have function like C, let's write a function like C. It's not going to sort things in a proper order. It's easy to see how to. So C takes an A, takes another A, and returns int, and then takes a list of A's, and returns a list of A's. Did I get this correct? Yeah. So now the question is that can I implement this function? Well, of course I can implement this function. I can, you know, it's probably, you know, could I actually do it live? Well, anyways, how does this work? I can apply this. Okay, I'll make a simpler function. I'm not going to sort things to mess things up. I'll make a function that sorts the two first elements of a list. That's easier for us. Just sort the first two and consider it done. So how can I do this? I have this op. Let's call it comp for comparison. And what can I do? Can I do anything? Yes, I have to return a list. So let's make an if statement. If I compare the first two elements and the result is, say, positive, then I take that as a meaning that x is a larger number. That's probably what you meant. If it was a negative, it would be the other way around. Then the result would be xy xs. And else, if it's not like that at all, then the result would be y x xs. So I certainly can make a function of that type. And it would compare first two elements. Everyone is in agreement with me. Then I think your claim was that I can make this function, but I can never use it. So do you still think that? Here's the trick. Here's the trick. Because if I call C, I'm now using this type, which means that currently I can decide what A is. When I call this function, I can decide, hey, I'm going to compare ints. So my function is probably going to take x and a y and then calculate x minus y, and that is my comparison operator. And then if I supply a list of numbers, of course it's going to work, because I decided what the A was. So what's the trick here? Because all of these other questions were leading that, no, you can't decide the A when you are implementing something. And then, of course, you are going to get this idea that you have to check for this. But when the A appears in some pre-existing value that I'm trying to use, then I can use any type in place of an A. So if I would like, I could, you know, use some function that returns a string for two characters, two lists. And I can even do something like this. And if I can spell things wrong, right. So as an answer to your question, if I'm using a value with a type variable, that's a great thing for me because I can decide what the type is. So correct and wrong at the same time. It's common here. Did you get the answer? Is this clear for you? No. Clear for everyone else? No. Do you have a question? Which part?
Any part.
Come to the supervised session, I'll sit next to you for an hour and then you understand. Or, I have no idea if you understand, but I'll bring coffee, so. Okay, back to this thing. We are probably quite clear on this part C. Okay, then we have a few short minutes. I have one interesting topic to discuss with you, because it's otherwise going to scare the hell out of you if I don't mention it. Any words about the rest A, B, and D? Anything to comment on those? Well, what is the problem with A? A is not correct, because I have a function that takes a single element of a list, and then a list of things. And the function looks only at the single element at a time. If I'm given a list of numbers 2, 1, 3, and you can only give me one element. You can give me, say, number one, and I can say that's less than something. I don't know what it's less than, but it's less than something. You can't actually use that to sort a list, because you can get the information only on one element at a time. To sort a list, you would need to know whether this element is somehow less than this other element. But if you just, you know, associate one other element to these lists, you can't really sort them in a sensible way. You can make something that does some sort of sorting with this, but it's going to be very limited. So that's an exercise for you. Try to implement this function A. Most people liked B. Any comments on B? Because B is not correct. B takes as a first argument a function that takes type A and type B, and it returns an odd. Then as a second argument, it takes list full of A's. Where is it going to get the B? I mean, it can't call the function here. It can't call this function because you don't have any B. B could be anything, and you don't get one as an input. So you can't do this. C we already discussed, and D. D is correct. You get the list of things that you are going to sort. You take a function that takes two elements, you can compare them, returns an ordering which is basically less than, equal, or more than, and then returns you a new list. However, this is not entirely correct. It has this constraint. It says that the elements A must be comparable. This is superfluous constraint, because if you already pass it a function that knows how to compare things, why would you need to compare A's? Because the function here does this comparing for you. You never have to use less than or more than or any other operator like this to compare two elements of type A. So you are saying that I give you some kind of an ordering, then you modify it inside of the function in some clever way and then sort according to that modified version. Yes, 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 you could do that. That is what the odd allows you to do. Without the odd, you can't actually mess up the ordering in a, you know, in any non-systematic way. Yeah. Composing basic types. Yeah, we have to skip this. Sorry. I'm not even going to make a screencast out of that because it saves you the pain. What I'm going to talk about for exactly 5.5 minutes is this next section, which is about deriving types or predicting types. And yeah, it's still on the screen more or less. This is the title for credit number 2. And during this part number 2 on this course, you are going to learn how you assign types in Haskell programs, how the type system works. It's going to be an approximation. It's not going to be the nitty-gritty all details version of how the type system works. It's going to be, you know, overview. It works kind of like this. And up to this point, we have struggled with intuition. We have tried to build up some kind of, you know, general feel of how types work. For example, the last two exercises, we have, you know, taken this intuitive view that, yeah, this might do thing like this. And this is how you actually work as a programmer. You take this intuition and then use the intuition and then you run into trouble and then you figure out how it really works. That's how you're supposed to do it, because any other way would be very slow. So the idea is that we are going to get to the point where your intuition was wrong and give you means of making exact answers. So we are going to learn how to calculate with types. You remember these derivations that we did, those very boring and very tedious exercises where you calculate with pen and a paper a result of a function. We are going to do that again with the types. And I know that many people have been saying that these derivation exercises are really the dumbest thing ever, because they take a lot of time, and once you've done a few of them, it's so simple that it just takes your time and doesn't give back anything. And this is the same thing. We want to get into position. We're doing these derivations with types. It's going to be, you know, the types are so obvious that you can just write them down and it just takes time. Because at that point you have learned how to work with types. But before that, I have no idea how to actually teach this topic in any exact way without making you do it by hand at least once or twice. And contrary to the part where we made derivations with values, we can't make derivations with types using just Haskell. It doesn't have notations that we can use to compute. So we add two additional notations. When I make these code examples, they are going to be syntax highlighted in a different way to make you realize that this is not Haskell anymore. We add this notation, column T, and some expression. When you write this, it means give me type of an expression, which is written after the T. For example, column T, kissa, which is cat, I think you all already knew, it's going to result in a string. Type of a string is a string. Type of list of booleans is a boolean. Type of function not is a function from boolean to boolean. This is exactly the same as you would have in GHI, except that you have to use pen and a paper or text editor to do it. Then we have this, in other notation, we have these French quotes, and then we write a type between them. This means any value of this type. So if we write French quotes int, means this could be any int. It could be 17, it could be 42, it could be 0, we don't care. Just some int, we don't care what it is. Then we have French quotes bool. That's some list of booleans. No idea, it could be empty list, contain one true, we don't care. The whole idea is that in Haskell, the values do not have any effect on the types. If your int is of value 100, it's still an int. It's always an int, regardless of the number. So, practically, we start from an expression. We abstract away the details until we have only the type. And the idea is that in types, types are a cross simplification of the functionality of the program. So if we look at the program in value level, it's going to be horribly complex. In type level, it's probably going to be very simple. So working with types allows us to save mental effort later. But now when we don't know how the types work, it's going to be slightly hard. So we make a very short example in less than 1 minute. I'm going to go over time for 2 minutes, I guess. So we are going to calculate a type of this expression, length Panama. Okay, everyone knows that this is an int, so it's a kind of a silly example, but it has to be simple so we can follow what's happening. Rule one, symbols can be replaced by arbitrary values of same type. So at this point, the length, it's a function from list of something into ints. So I can write French quotes, function from list of somethings into ints. I don't need to know what it actually does. If it's a length function, it's just something of that type. Then I can take and do the same for the string. I have something that takes list of a's, converts it to ints. Then I have an application. That function is applied some list of characters. I do not care anymore what the characters are or what the function does. Rule two. If I have a situation like this, this is a function application. I have a function and I have an argument. If the first part of the function or the domain of the function matches the type of the argument, I can call the function or I can do a function application. But here it does not match. I have rule two that says that I can replace type variables with any type I like. So I can write in place of a char. Gives me some function of list of characters into ints, applied list of characters. No, not very difficult. Then I can continue. Since I have a function that takes a list of characters and returns an int, it's given some value of type list of characters, I'm going to get an int out of the function. For all functions taking a to b, when applied with a, result in a b. This is some int. I have no idea what int it is, I don't care. And then the final rule. If I have type of some element of a type something, then the type is obvious. And this is basically, you know, with few extensions, what the whole second credit is about. If you get this, you get one credit. In that's the only thing actually you have to do for the second credit. So it means that you can spend 26 hours of work just to get this, and it's not that hard in the end. And yeah, if you feel scared, it's more notation, more types, more lines. Don't be. It's easy when you get it. It takes time to get it, but that's just how life is. Do a few. If there's too many exercises, do as many as you need. Don't bore yourself if you just got the idea already. And that's it for the day. Have fun the rest of the week.
Se oli niinku se, että